you're always on call, basically. So your mind is always set in a way that you have to be ready anytime.
This multilateral cooperation of different countries saying, these are our best experts in this area of work. Take them, train them in the same methodology, and these people from across the world being able to come together in one team and support other people who are affected, who are just like them. This is what makes me proud to work for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, but also what makes me really proud to work for the United Nations.
Gintare Edimtete and Stefania Trissari, two members of the UN Disaster Assessment and Coordination, or UNDAC, team based in Geneva, who are poised to go anywhere at any time as the organisation's first line of response when disaster strikes. Around 1,270 team members have deployed all across the world in the past 25 years, and more than 80 countries and organisations have more than 200 experienced UNDAC members with the know-how to make life-saving calls as crucial first responders. I'm Matt Wells in New York, and to mark this 25-year milestone, UN News' Daniel Johnson, who's based in Geneva, gathered a group of UNDAC staff members together in our podcast studio there to talk about the challenges they face heading towards disaster when most are doing their best to head the other way.
Peter Muller, Gintare Edimtete, Stefania Trissari and Winston Chang. Welcome to you all.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
The United Nations Disaster Assessment and Coordination Unit, which relies on a network of around 300 first responders, is celebrating its 25th anniversary. I'm not sure happy birthday is quite the right thing to say, but it does give us a chance to see how the idea was born. Peter, perhaps you'd like to pick up the conversation, because you've, without meaning to be indelicate, you've been here the longest.
Okay, thank you, Daniel. The UNDAC team was basically conceived in the early 90s after a couple of very big emergencies, earthquakes, where there was a need for teams to be going abroad, search and rescue teams from different member states, helping other member states. There was also a recognition that those teams need to be coordinated. So that started in 1993. Since then, I think we've done 281 plus missions, and it's 25 years. And of course, the system has changed a lot since then. And it's not only earthquakes, but it's now a lot of other types of emergencies, floods, cyclones, tsunamis, etc.
Sure. So I just want to get an idea of what it actually means when you get the call. So Gintare, maybe I could come to you. You work here in Geneva. A typical day probably doesn't exist in your book. But, you know, when you get the call, it gives me a chance to say that cliche. You know, what happens when disaster strikes?
So for me, it's usually I pick up the phone and call my husband first. And every time it's the same story. I was like, but you have to go now, because he doesn't have a problem with me going away. He has a problem with it being within a few hours. I keep a backpacked with all my clothes for the field. We have a kit that we receive once we become part of the UNDAC family. So you have the standard kit. You take out the things that you don't need, depending on the country you're going and the climate. You put some other things that you need in it, and then you start calling your colleague saying, okay, over the next month or 3 weeks, I'm not going to be here. What work do I have to hand over? You call your mom, you call your dad, you call your sister, you calm them down, you tell them everything's going to be fine. They're worried because they always assume the worst. So for instance, in 2014, I deployed with the UNDAC team to Liberia in response to the Ebola crisis. So the way I saw it, and when I went, we were probably some of the first UN people to arrive in Liberia in response to that emergency. I really didn't perceive it as being a dangerous mission, because we were not going to be in hospitals or, you know, in touch with the patients. We were sitting in an emergency operation center trying to set up the coordination structures. But my dad really imagined that I was wearing, you know, the full personal protective equipment and, you know, I was almost working like a nurse. So it really took a bit of time to calm them down. But they're very supportive and very proud of the work that we do.
Stefania, you work closely with Gintare Edimtete, who has just explained what it's like on a day-to-day basis. Would you share that opinion? I know that in the past I've heard Gintare say it's like, well, her parents think it's like being in the military. It's like almost going to the front line.
Yeah, exactly. So you're always on call, basically. So your mind is always set in a way that you have to be ready anytime of the year. So you kind of, you know, get used to that type of mindset. It had some, you know, spice into your life as well, because all of a sudden, you know, you might plan holidays, or you know, you might have your personal plan, and then all of a sudden, if there is an hurricane or a cyclone somewhere, you know that you might be deployed. So you need, you know, you start, you know, thinking about getting prepared for this mission. And as Gintare said, you need to inform, you know, people around you. It's definitely intense as a job, but it's quite rewarding, I must say. You work long hours. At the same time, you know that you're there to help the country that's been affected by the calamities. Last year in September, where we had the Hurricane Irma and Maria affected the Caribbean. So basically, we had this request coming from one of the Caribbean countries affected by the hurricane to deploy a NUDAC team. And I was ready, so I had my bag in the office, ready to go after work in France with one of my best friends. So she was waiting for me outside the office, and then all of a sudden I had to call and say, I'm really sorry, but my boss has asked me to stay here and take care of this deployment. So I had to cancel at the very last minute. And this happens quite often. I mean, I might say that I had to cancel two or three holidays.
But even when you're on holiday, do you remember in August I had just joined the team and you were back home with your mom?
Yes.
And Stefania covers the African region and I cover the Americas. But I was pretty much the only person in the office for some reason, because everybody was in a training or something. And suddenly I had to deploy a team to Sierra Leone because there was a mudslide. So Stefania, we're together on WhatsApp and coordinating, and she was giving me advice. So even if you're on holiday, you're not really on holiday because you're always on call.
Winston Chang, you were recently in Iraq at the end of last year. There was a massive earthquake, 7.3 on the Richter scale. The epicenter of this quake was 32 kilometers from Halabja. Approximately 1.8 million people lived within a 100-kilometer radius of that epicenter in both Iraq and Iran. You were out there as one of the first responders. Tell us what you found and what your mission was.
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. Well, 2 points stood out in the mission. The lightning speed at which our visas were approved was unprecedented.
I guess that is important.
Yeah, especially for Iraq, where, you know, in normal cases, you might need to wait for months to have a visa, yes. And in fact, the earthquake occurred at 9 p.m. that evening. And by the next morning, the authorities decided that international assistance was necessary. And all five of us had our visas and ready to jump on the next available flight that same day. This was because the authorities had worked closely with our OCHA Iraq office, who had a previous...
Hang on, have an acronym alert there. OCHA, you just said. So that's the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. I get 10 points there, everyone, because I get so the next one, you could go for that. But that's 10 points to the good for me. Carry on, Winston.
Yeah, it's important that governments know that they have full access to a United Nations expert team that can jump on a plane within hours and provide value-added support. Now, what did we do there? This is the second point. We were tasked with two important roles. First, to check if the Durban Deccan Dam, this is a huge dam holding 3 billion cubic meters of water. You can imagine how much water there is there. And if the earthquake would have caused a serious damage, then you can imagine downstream that the villages would all be flooded.
I reported on this at the time, and you sent me some photos back from Durban Deccan Dam. There were lampposts that were leaning. There were certainly there were holes in the top of the dam. So rather worrying if you're downstream of that dam, as you say. So that was one of your major objectives, to assess whether this enormous structure was safe.
I think the unique feature of the International Response System, which we call UNDEC, is that we co-opt experts. In this instance, we had a hydro engineer from the European Union together with the team. And with this expertise, we were able to work closely with the technical experts in country, as well as others from the World Bank, for example, that were there. And together, they were able to agree that the dam was safe.
That the level of damage, is it something you probably never get used to? But I guess that's another question, really. How do you deal with what you see?
We were very impressed with the affected population. They have experienced several wars in the last few decades, as we all know. They are a very hardy bunch. And definitely in this instance, they were totally caught off guard, because no one, a whole generation, never experienced or felt an earthquake in their lives.
Has anyone else got a memory that they would care to share? You've spoken, Jintari, about Ebola already in Liberia. Stefania, is there anything that's really stayed with you in the time you've been at the unit?
So yes, it was during my last deployment with the UNDAC. He was 2 years ago for the Hurricane Matthew in Haiti. So I deployed immediately. I was actually coming from another mission. I was deployed to Tanzania for an earthquake, and then straight from Tanzania, I flew to Haiti. The level of damage, the destruction that there was that I saw in Haiti was quite bad, and we had to work quite closely with national authorities in Haiti, of course, and also with all the humanitarian organizations. It seems quite straightforward if you bring food or water or whatever humanitarian aid you're bringing to the affected population. You think that it's going to be easy actually to distribute it, but it's sometimes you have to face quite a big number of challenges.
Such as roads existing, lack of infrastructure, no houses, no.
Yeah, security. In Haiti was a big issue for us. Access to the population was hampered by a lot of security problem. Actually, a lot of trucks were looted. For example,
Because the population is desperate.
Exactly.
People are desperate for food.
Some people are desperate for food, sure, but other people also take the opportunity to just steal and do criminal act. So it's not always actually easy to deal with this type of situation, because from one side you have the population is waiting impatiently to get assisted, but on the other side you also have groups of people that take advantage. As a humanitarian worker, you need to protect yourself, you need to respect some security measures, or be able to know where to go out, where and how. So you need to get all this information before you actually go out in the field and help the population. As you assist the other people, you also take care of yourself. So which means eating. Sometimes we don't take it for granted, but on mission you actually tend to forget that this is actually important. Sleeping, because you need to get ready and be in shape and be able to actually perform well. So you don't have to forget about this, simple but very, very important.
And keeping your sense of humor, which is absolutely essential in stressful situations.
Yes. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I perhaps have a story that I really like to remember from my first deployment with UNDAC, which was to the Philippines in response to Typhoon Haiyan. And I had never seen this level of destruction anywhere.
This is going back to 2013?
2013, yes. And there were many difficult moments, but it was an excellent deployment in a sense that I think it was a very complete UNDAC mission, and we were really able to provide a lot of services to the responding community. A lot of times we talk about, a certain disconnect between all these people that come from across the world, they land in a country and they start doing their work and distributing food, and the affected population, which I think for many years was seen as kind of all these people waiting to receive assistance. And more, thankfully, humanitarian response is getting transformed to saying these are the people at the center of everything they do. They have to be consulted, they have to be involved, they have to be part of our work in a very integral way. And there are many tools done for that, but my favorite one, which was such a simple thing to bring us closer together, was there was a non-governmental organization called Internews in the Philippines who were working on kind of improving this community engagement and the communication between the responders and the affected people. And they were shopping in Manila to set up a radio, so they needed different technical things, and they saw a karaoke machine. And the two guys told me, we just looked at each other, so we're getting that karaoke machine. So they brought it to Giwan, to the small village where we were based. And every Friday, they would have a karaoke session, which they would broadcast on the radio. And it was the first radio they had restored. And all these people would come from the community, and they would invite the responders to sit on the panel as judges and also to perform. And our team leader of the UNDAC team was one of the people who had the courage to stand up and perform. So every Friday...
I wish we had a recording of this. I really do. Maybe we could get one for the for our listeners. I'm sure they'd appreciate it. But I know, Jintari, you said that you were helping with the Ebola response. Before we came on air, you said it also was a massive challenge. It showed the limits and the limitations of being able to respond to you know, really extreme emergencies, ones that the world has rarely seen. So, Peter, maybe the question to you, because you were here right at the beginning of the creation of UNDEC. You know, what are the limitations of emergency response? And I guess the next question would really be, where will UNDEC be in another 25 years, if at all? Because really what you want is governments to have the capacity to help themselves, don't you?
Yeah, you're right. I think things have changed a lot over the last, 20, 25 years. And the cliche is, of course, that we have to work ourselves out of a job. And, of course, that almost never happens. But actually, when you look at 25 years in which we have the occasion now, I think we're sort of doing that. If you went out to the field 20 years ago, you just went with a team to a disaster area. There was nothing there, right? There was nothing there. People were not well prepared. Governments had very little organization, coordination. NGOs were maybe doing development work. So there was not much there, maybe apart from the Red Cross and some other response organizations. Now you see so many actors, there's so much information that immediately is coming to everybody, including affected people. So the expectations are much higher. Also, the capacities, of course, are much higher. So I think in a way, that is also where we have contributed as an UNDEC system by, you know, sharing the lessons of those early years where governments and other organizations have been able to learn from that. And I think for me, that's also one of the key benefits of the UNDEC system, but also of the work that we're doing, is that you're doing this work, you prepare, you respond, you learn as a network, as a group of organizations, and as a group of people, and then you improve. So in terms of working yourself out of a job, I think that's what we're constantly doing, because it's constantly evolving. But of course it continues, because, you know, we have climate change, we have conflict, we have development processes that sometimes are not going as they should. So there's more people that will actually be exposed to a lot of risk of natural disasters, of conflict, etc. So there will be definitely more humanitarian needs. We see that on an annual basis every year, the last 10, 20 years. And so we have to reinvent ourselves as a response system as well.
And how do you do that, though, given that, you know, you're a very small team? I mean, you are aware of climate change and low-lying communities, small island states. Dominica, you know, you were involved with the total devastation there, and we're going to be seeing a lot more of that, apparently. Yeah. So that's something that perhaps you strategically look at, do you, when you get a spare moment, when you're not flying off here, there and everywhere?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, we are a small team, if you like, of 300 active people. But the actual network of organizations, of member states, of international organizations is much bigger, of course. That consists of thousands of people and hundreds of organizations. So it's sort of a tip of the spear kind of thing. And so it's that network that needs to pull together, that needs to learn together, that needs to exchange experiences and improve systems, to be ready for these changes in the future.
I mean, there are very committed, dedicated, and passionate people who really want to help and do a lot of good things. So that is always, you know, good to see when you are on mission, when you are facing a very, you know, difficult and challenging situations, to see, you know, that people are coming together. And we are, you know, creating a team that is strong and is, you know, able to face all these challenges despite the problem we face. This passion really motivates me a lot and gives me, you know, the strength to continue and the energy to actually contribute myself to this to disaster management.
What's the message? Invest in people. People are what makes the service UNDEC such
Definitely.
A success, and despite, you know, meager resources, you know, there's only five of you, for example, going out to a disaster zone.
To me, I completely agree with Stefania. It's all about the people, and to me, UNDEC is an example of what the United Nations do best, you know, or what we should be doing in all of our areas of work. We don't come in to fix everything, you know, kind of as these gods that kind of descend from the sky. We work with people, we find capacity that exists across the world in all these different cultures. So this multilateral cooperation of different countries saying, these are our best experts in this area of work, and take them, train them in the same methodology, and these people from across the world being able to come together in one team and work and support other people who are affected, who are just like them. To me, this is what makes me proud to work for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Efforts, but also what makes me really proud to work for the United Nations.
Winston Chang, Peter Muller, Jintari Adimtete, Stefania Trasari, Many thanks for coming in. Best of luck with the year. I hope that it brings some really positive experiences despite the difficulties that you encounter.
Thank you so much, Daniel.
Daniel Johnson in Geneva there, with four special guests from the UN Disaster Assessment and Coordination Team, UNDAC, 25 years old this year. That's it from this latest edition of our UN News interview podcast series. You can find more of our podcasts to listen to by going to soundcloud.com/UN Radio. Thanks for listening.